Presented by RomulusIT.com, offering remote support for common computer problems. Landry.audio, listen, like, and subscribe. Today we're speaking with champion kickboxer and K1 legend Ray Seffo. Ray was the 2000 K1 World Grand Prix runner-up with wins over Jerome LeBanner, Peter Ert, Stefan Lecko, Mike Bernardo, and Marco Hunto. He's now based in Las Vegas, where he teaches out of Randy Couture's Extreme Couture and is also the CEO of Professional Fighters League, or PFL. How are things on that side of the world today, Ray?
It's good. It's good. It's, as you know, the whole world has gone through this pandemic, and so you just kind of cope with it and do the best you can. But no complaints here. You know, things in Vegas has been actually pretty good. So all in all, it's good. But, you know, just like anything, you just got to keep grinding away.
Yeah, it's been easier to get some of these interviews lately because it's almost people don't have anything to do, and they're almost kind of looking for a little bit of company, which is good. So
that's right.
Well, look, for people that don't know you, you're a legend in the stand up fight game, and as I said, some of our recent interviews we've done, Mike Schiavello, Peter Graham, and now that we're sort of doing these podcasts, I love kind of reviewing this time, which is what got me into the sport initially in the early 2000s in my time period. But you're recognized as a proud Kiwi, as a New Zealander, but I've read that you've got Samoan descent, and I'm sure as you're not familiar with, especially as you're now based in the States these days, not many people understand the difference between the island or Pacific nations. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about, you know, your cultural background in that area of the world?
Yeah, obviously the South Pacific is made of so many different islanders. From me, myself, being Samoan, and there's Tongan, there's Rarotongan, there's Niueans, Tahiti's all kind of like along that same coast, if you will, Hawaii and whatnot. But we're all from a small little island, if you will. And New Zealand's not a big place either, you know what I mean?
It's not either. I'm Canadian, relocated to Australia, and it really, I tell everyone, it feels like we are tucked away in the corner, and New Zealand's even, you know, pushed a little bit further down there. What was it like growing up for you in that environment before, kind of making your name on the world stage?
I was just a young, the typical Polynesian kid. We, you know, school was school, and things that we did at home was, being a young Polynesian, you get taught how to clean up and cook and wash dishes and do the laundry. And these are things you learn when you're like 5, 6, 7 years old. You know what I mean? But other than that, I mean, I remember, my dad gave me my first boxing gloves when I was 5. And I come from a boxing family. My dad was a boxer. My cousin's family, you know, everybody boxed. But I still remember as a kid, I would be sparring my cousins and brothers at the age I was 5, 6, and they were 6, 7, 8, you know, upwards, you know what I mean? And I'm told I have my own. But no, yeah, you know, just a normal childhood where, you know, school, you go to school, you come home, you do your homework, and then play outside a little bit with your friends and whatnot. And then the next day, it's the same thing over and over.
So I, as I mentioned, I reached out to Michael Schiavello for people who don't know who that is. He became synonymous as the English speaking K1 commentator who now works for ONE Championship. And he was pretty adamant about asking you about your time bouncing and as a male model, which I wasn't aware of. So he said that you'll probably get some good info there. So I think that's a good place to start off.
Yeah, no, God. You know, Mike is a brother from another mother.
Yeah.
But we traveled the world together. We commentated a lot of shows, especially K1 and whatnot. So at the age of 16, I believe, I started modeling. And I did that for 10 years, from you know, still photo shoots to the runway to TV commercials to very small parts here and there on, you know, with film, whether it be TV or movie. And they were all part of amazing parts of my journey because I never dreamt that, you know, this young Polynesian kid would be, you know, doing that kind of thing or be on the runway, you know, modeling. And so I just kind of took it in stride and just enjoyed every second of it.
And what about the bouncing stuff? You know, I was reading Mark Hunt's book. It seems like a lot of you guys sort of were involved in bouncing or this was the way to make your money during the nights when you weren't training. There's got to be some fascinating stories around there. And especially with an area like, you know, like Auckland, including yourself, you guys are big guys down there.
Yeah. I mean, bouncing, when I realized that, competing was where I wanted to be, and I wanted to take that to, and I realized that at a very young age. The only job that would allow you to make, you know, $500 to $800 a week was to be a bouncer. And, you know, you work, let's say, 3-4 days and you're already at the time I was also, you know, I had a little apartment, and so that covered the bills, you know, and it still allowed me to train full time. So that's how I got into that line of work. And of course, I was 19 at the time, and I'm not saying for anybody to go do this, but I ended up telling a little white lie in regards to my age. I said I was 21, but I was 19. But because these guys had already seen me on television doing TV commercials and doing demonstrations with martial arts and whatnot, they were like, oh, okay. You know, they kind of went with it and just took my word for it. And so I got the job.
So
that's how it started.
What brought you to kickboxing? You said you've got a family lineage of boxing. You know, we tend to see some kickboxers go to boxing because there's more money in it, but you don't normally see guys who grew up in boxing make the transition.
So what happened was, I think I was seven, I want to say 7 or 8, and my dad rented a Bruce Lee movie. I think it was Fist of Fury.
It's always the case, isn't it? It's
right.
Bruce Lee, for you, I would have been Van Damme, and that was it. Use the feet, right?
Yeah, so it was. He rented two movies that day. It was a Jackie Chan movie and a Bruce Lee movie, and they happened to be, you know, some of my idols in martial arts, and I was like, wow! And that was the first time I had seen anything like that, you know, throwing kicks and elbows and all this kind of stuff. It was just truly amazing to me. I was just so taken by it, and. So at the age of 12, I decided that's something that I wanted to do. And of course, for me to do that, I had to make some money to do that. And so I was a milk boy at the age of 12, delivering milk. And that's how, you know, we did that. And so martial arts was really from watching Jackie Chan and Bruce Lee on you know, in the movies.
Where did you end up getting into kickboxing? Because the path for a lot of kids is they tend to have like a traditional martial arts background of like karate or taekwondo before they then take like a legitimate step into more combat-based sports like, you know, kickboxing or Muay Thai or something along those lines.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. And for me, I ended up, I started with Wing Chun, Wing Chun Kung Fu. I did that for 6 years. And then the crazy thing was that I realized when I got into a street fight, I was always boxing and kicking more like a kickboxer rather than a traditional kung fu fighter, if you will, or martial artist. And I found out every time I got into a situation like that, or whether I was protecting my friend or brother or whatever, or myself, I would always end up doing more of a kickboxing style. And so at 18, I switched over from that, from Wing Chun to Muay Thai. I wanted to try, you know, and see what was the difference. And I found Muay Thai for me was, it was more my style that fitted what I, how I would. And I think maybe because I had already started boxing at a, such a young age, you know, being taught by, you know, my dad and some of my cousins that were obviously older. And so, yeah, that's how Muay Thai came about. And of course, you know, with Muay Thai, we would, you know, you can use elbows and knees and clinches and whatnot. So, and I found that, you know, more suited to me as a martial artist.
I was going to ask this question a little bit later, but we're kind of already there. You know, a lot of people practice or just do martial arts as a hobby. And, you know, there's, right, there's 1,001 different types of this. You've sort of, you know, having worked bouncing, you would have seen what these fights look like in a street environment, which is different, right, to someone training to operate in a ring. What sort of advice or what do you think kind of becomes the best basis just for the purpose of self-defense if you're not going to actually fight?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, when I did martial arts, I never wanted to fight. Right. Fighting was something that I kind of just stumbled on. And going back to your question, Ben, and then we'll cover
that. And then we'll come to that. But, okay.
Right, right. So, I want to say, listen, every artist, you know, there's a purpose for every art that's been created, if you will. Obviously some a lot more realistic than others. And as we know today, there are so many fake coaches and instructors out there. So my advice to anybody that wants to do martial arts for self-defense, look into how it works. And because when I see you people teach this chi nonsense on TV and people go flying and whatnot, run as fast as you can because, you know, they probably just want your money. Yeah. But what I find, I think for me, especially with the evolution of MMA today, I think when you can box, kickbox, and wrestle or even jiu-jitsu, then I think you covered all your bases. Mainly just boxing and kickboxing for when you're on your feet, wrestling and jiu-jitsu when you're on your, you know, when you're on your, when, if you get, if it happens that you get taken down. So that combination there, I think it's a win-win combination with, whether, you know, and again, you could be boxing, you don't need to be kicking either. I mean, as long as you know how to defend a takedown or, and listen, most cases when you, if you're going to get into a situation like that, it's really against people that don't really know too much about martial arts. That being said, I would say boxing, kickboxing, and jiu-jitsu and wrestling.
Just the core of what we know now.
Exactly.
Yep. You would have grown up or actually, hold on. Before we ask that, you were going to talk about how you stumbled into professional fighting, which I'm sure is a story in and of itself.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I never wanted to be a fighter, but I was in love with learning how to fight. I was in love with martial arts and what it taught. It taught a lot of things about discipline and, you know, and confidence and whatnot. But yeah, no, fighting was the last thing on my mind until we went to a weigh-in where one of my teammates was supposed to fight this guy. And he was diagnosed by the doctor that he had a bad case of asthma and that he wasn't allowed to compete. And so then one guy ended up ended up challenging me to a fight.
Right.
And I was like, sure. You know, again, fighting wasn't the thing that I wanted to do. And my mind was saying no. And my heart was like, well, I don't know if you can cuss on here, but he was like, my heart was like, yeah, well, F you. You know what I mean? let's get it done. And so I think weeks later, that got matched. And I ended up fighting this guy. And, man, I was nervous because it was the first time I was in front of thousands of people or hundreds of people. I think that arena itself held 1,500 people or something like that.
Okay.
So now, you know, for the first time, you're in front of all these people watching you live. And so whatever, if you messed up, you know, it was embarrassing, if you will.
Yeah.
And so I trained, you know, my butt off, and long story short, I win the fight. And I think his record at the time was 5-2, and that was my first. And that was the beginning of how, so I have him to thank, you know, for kind of that, for challenging me to actually really pushing me towards what I was actually meant to do in my life. Mm. Because when I think about where I'm at, where I am today, there is no way I could say, or anybody could say, that this is not, that I wasn't meant to do this. You know what I mean?
Right.
Do
you believe in some form of destiny?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, 100%. This is my destiny, was to be a martial artist, a fighter, to then becoming a coach to help others achieve their goals, and then starting my own fight league with amazing partners that allows us to give fighters another opportunity to continue, you know, down that path like I started, where I started, you know what I mean? And so, yeah, I thank God every day that I get to do what I love to do and so passionate about.
What do you think is the role, or how do you continue to be a martial artist as you age? And what I mean by that, and I think you'll understand what I mean. You know, most fighters are, maybe until they're about 35, they're sort of in their heyday. If you're in the upper classes, you can last normally until, you know, you might be about 40. But martial arts and combat is all based around, you know, fitness, speed, footwork, all the things that you begin to lose, yeah, as you get a little bit older. So your ability to learn grows. So you know more about martial arts, but you can do less. What do you think that sort of does for the role of a person, and if someone wants to be a practitioner into their 60s, 70s, and 80s?
In terms of years old?
Yeah.
Like an age? Being a martial artist, you'll always be a martial artist by learning. But in competition, a lot of people, what I found is that, I mean, like, I'm in the gym still today, and I still spar 3 days a week, and I still hold my own against some of these 25-year-old guys. I'm going to be 15 in February. And I'm sparring guys like Roy Nelson, Francis Ngannou, Ronnie Marks, Misha Cherkinov, Carl, like all these top level guys who fight, Brad Tavares, you know, and really I've equated that to me living my life clean. Mm. I think a lot of these guys who were young fighters, they love the training, they love the competition, but they also love to party. And it's okay to go out and have a good time, but it's not okay to go out and like drink for the next 3-4 weeks nonstop kind of thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that's where a lot of people don't, in terms of their life, fighting life, they only go to a certain time frame. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I remember, I think I was in my mid-20s. I could have been 24, 25. And I was like, and I remember seeing one of my brothers, one of my dad's older brother, And I was like, man, he was only like 30 something, like 33, 34. And I'm like, damn, he looks old. You're like, the way he acted old, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But of course, I didn't take into account what he was doing in life and whatnot. I just kind of thought his age, and I thought, okay, maybe by 32, then I'm done with this. You know what I mean? I hit 32 and I was at my prime. And you know, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do drugs. I never have, in terms of like, I've never been attracted to that. Or felt the need to do any of that. And so I lived very clean as an athlete, and I think a lot of that helped me continue to grow as a martial artist, as a fighter, but also it kept me in the game a very long time. And then even today, it keeps me in the gym where I'm coaching, you know, and I'm in the gym 6 days a week. And so whether I'm coaching or training or sparring and whatnot, or doing gi, jiu-jitsu, or grappling, all these things have been, I'm able to do because I've lived very clean. I think as long as you're true to yourself and live healthy and live well, then I think you can do things as long as your body allows you to do.
What are your thoughts on hard sparring? You would have come from a different generation where now we know a lot about CTE and,
right.
You know, especially with, you know, I'm more of an MMA guy than I was stand up, but, you know, I remember right. The early onset of Ken Shamrock's Lion's Den, where it was just sort of, you know, KO or BKO'd. We know a lot about the stories right. of Dutch kickboxing gyms where it's, you know, 100% all the time. What's your theory on sparring to that degree as part of training?
I think it's crazy.
Yeah.
I've never had to fight any of my teammates because sparring was so hard. In other words, sure, you know, when you're training and you're sparring, everything is, in my opinion, I think when it's, you can go 50, 60%. But once you go to 100% and your fighters, now it becomes, you know, a challenge. And now you're fighting to not only defend yourself, but also battle with your teammate and not learning. When you get to that kind of part of your game, you know, you're now not – the purpose of training and sparring and is to learn, not to, you know, not to take punishment every day or every other day, if you will. So I don't believe in hard sparring. But I do understand, like, you know, when you're 3 weeks out from a fight, the intensity starts to, you know, get higher. And I get it. So what happens is that you should be sparring guys with the same kind of level of fitness and whatnot, because now you can go a little bit harder, but you also are both in the understanding.
The reaction time, the finesse right. is all sort of on par.
Right, exactly. And then everything still equals out and you're still putting in the work rather than, you know, beating up a guy that's only been in the gym for 3 weeks and you're fighting in 3 weeks. You know what I mean? So to me, that's ridiculous. That being said, again, I mean, to answer your question, no, I don't believe in hard sparring. I believe in that you should go 50, 60%. And then every now and then, you're going to throw something and somebody will walk into it. And out of respect, you go, oh, you know, sorry, I didn't mean that. But, you know, but up here, still ticking at 100 miles an hour, learning and also adapting to what's happening.
Do you, you know, I think probably the prime example in our sport is the damage that happened to Gary Goodridge from a long career fighting. Have Do you feel any side effects after having gone through this so long, or, you know, other people that suffer from this? And is there anything that the sport can do longer term to, I guess, ensure this doesn't happen to other athletes?
Me personally, thank God, knock on wood. I think I'm fine. so far, I haven't, you know, got any of those effects. That being said, Gary Goodrich is a friend, and I had heard stories about Gary. And then one day he calls me, and I had a missed call, so I called him back, and I said, hey Gary, how you doing, brother? It's Ray here. I had a missed call from you. And he says, oh, hey, blah, 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 hung up. And then, 2 or 3 minutes later, he calls me back and he says, and I answered the phone and he says, who's this? Because he saw the number, and I'm like, Gary, it's me. It's Ray. And then he started telling me, about, you know, his situation. And also, he even said, Ray, did I already have this conversation with you? I'm like, yeah. And then that's when he started telling me about the situation. And the unfortunate part of this is that you can't escape it, in a sense of you can't not train to compete at its, whether it be boxing, kickboxing, and not get hit. You know what I mean?
Contact is necessary to get into the game, right? Effectively.
Exactly. Mm. I mean, I didn't even know until, I want to say 3 to 4 years ago, there was a massive, or 5 years ago, there was a huge, there was a documentary on the NFL, American football. Mm-hmm. Where a lot of these guys were, you know, getting trauma because of just a lot of the head clashing. And I thought that him having helmets was, you know, would prevent that from happening, or at least not as bad. But obviously that isn't the truth. You know what I mean? Like,
well, I think I know which doctor you're talking about. I don't think I've seen that, but from what I'm read of it, it starts to change, I think, the frontal cortex or something, and over time for a lot of people, it makes them more aggressive. And I think this is what they were talking about, issues of like domestic violence and suicide as they get older, The concussion itself begins to actually, manipulate the brain in some way.
Again, like I said, that's the tough part about the full contact sport is that you really can't escape it, other than don't compete. Mm. You know what I mean? Because you need sparring, you need to be getting punches where you can actually adjust your eyes to it, and so you can slip and move. Yeah. And of course, you know, you're not going to slip and move on every punch. And so that's the tough part about this disease is that you can't escape it unless you don't fight it.
Yeah. You mentioned his name. I got to ask you about Francis Ngannou. That man has Tyson-esque power in a way that I don't think anyone has seen. You know, right. even Tyson needed to put combos together to knock people out. Francis just seems like he can walk up to you with the touch of God and put you to sleep. How do you spar with someone like him? And what are your thoughts on his, you know, natural knockout talent?
Oh, he's very strong. You know what I mean? And we've all witnessed him putting people away. And he's not the easiest. He's not an easy guy to spar, because he's so big and long, and also because he's so light on his feet. for a big guy. You know what I mean? And of course, you know, him, especially like this guy's going to be so dangerous because, you know, he's training with some of the boys like Ronnie Marks and Misha and Carr and those guys and Tim, who he's grappling with. And, you know, a lot of these guys are black belts. And, you know, Francis is just in that group where they're just constantly working and helping him evolve. And he's just going to be such a dangerous man when he actually, when nobody can take him down, or if you do take him down, he you know, will look to snap off your arm or your neck, you know, like with all the grappling he's been doing. So, yeah, no, he's a special athlete, Francis.
Were you involved with him in the first Stipe fight? I think a lot of us were kind of blown away how getting to that title fight stage kind of incapacitated him to a degree.
Right. I think he was training it out. Like he was coming and going at our gym at the time. I wasn't really sure. I know he was working with another good friend of mine, Dewey Cooper, who's still his striking, coach today. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure where he was fully training there. But I know that he was, you know, at that time he was going back and forth. But now he's, you know, for the last, I want to say the last year, he's been full time with us.
Okay.
At Extreme Couture. Yeah.
So I got involved in the sport. So when I'm from Canada originally, and one of the guys that I was working with around the early 2000s, they had just released the UFC DVDs, and he was a Japanese Canadian guy, and he had family over in Japan, and he would go visit them quite frequently. And we got around to talking about it. He said, "Do you like this stuff?" And I remembered it from the late 90s, where, you know, right, it was really the truly no holds barred. It was like, "Oh, people are dying in the ring," that sort of talk. And he goes, "Well, this stuff is still kicking off and it's going off in Japan." He goes, "Do you know anything about this stuff?" And I said, "No." And he brought me in these VHS tapes that he had family record from them. It was, he, you know, remember when they used to record on EP mode so you could get 6 hours out of like one VHS tape? And he brought me in K1 and Pride at the time when it was on Japanese television. And that was kind of my introduction to the sport around 2002, 2003, sort of as a revival where I then got into my training. There's a generation of kids now who just have no clue of what was going on in Japan and how big K1 was. Tell me about how you got involved with them and just, you know, how big this was at the time when you were involved.
K1 was seen over 140 something countries around the world. It was, when we fought at the Tokyo Dome, where it was like 70 or 80,000 people live in the arena. And in Japan alone, there was like 3 to 4 million people watched it on TV. And of course, the Grand Prix went live worldwide as well. K1 was so big. And part of that too was it was on Eurosport, I think 3-4 times a week.
Right. Okay.
I remember going to Europe. I remember going to Croatia for the first time. You know, people knew who we were, to Czech Republic, and was getting mobbed in the streets. I mean, it didn't matter where we went. Everybody knew who we were, and yet that was the first time we had gone there. And so that it was then that I knew it was massive in Japan.
Okay.
You get mobbed everywhere we went. So we knew, but we didn't know really until I started traveling the world and more so, and then realized that everybody knew about it. I was dating a girl out of Austria and, she's like, "Yeah, I don't think many people know you in Austria." Well, I go to visit her and I get off the plane and the first person I run into, "Oh, Ray Seffel," you know?
All right.
And I was like, oh, okay. And so, and then one of my bags got, one of my bags was actually, it got lost somewhere. And so I had to, I had to stay back and fill in forms and whatnot. While I'm standing there, you know, trying to figure out all these like police officers, workers, they all came and wanted to take a photo and, you know, autograph signing and whatnot. And then I said, hey, is it possible to let my girlfriend know that I'm here because she might be worried? They're like, yeah, no problem. So they took me out, grabbed her, and brought her back into customs. Okay. You know, so that's things like that, for example, just kind of told me how massive K1 was, because and how people really loved, you know, that era and the show. And so it was, you know, it was pretty huge. I remember one of my friends from here, one of our other, John Alessio, who fought in
another great Nagoya. Canadian, another great Canadian, Ray.
Right, exactly. Your countryman. So John, who's a good friend, was I was in Japan, and I got an email from John saying, hey, can you corner me while you're there? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. So I stayed another week. And so Jake Bonacci, who's also another good friend of ours, who was our strength and conditioning coach at Extreme Couture. So him and I cornered John there. And so one, you know, a couple of nights before the show, I took John out because I had an Australian friend in Nagoya that lived in Nagoya. So he, you know, he was going to show us around in Nagoya. So Jake and I get out of the cab, and all these, this guy saw me and, oh, they said, what's up? And just ran. And the whole street ran down to the cab. And of course, Jake was like, what the hell is going on here? You know what I mean? I'm like, just get in the cab. So we jumped back into the cab, and they were sticking their phones through the car, you know, just taking photos and whatnot. And it's just, so, yeah, the sport was massive, you know. And even to hear, you know, Jake, who's been, you know, around the game a long time and trained Randy Couture and a lot of Vito Belfort and a lot of other people that, and he was like, man, this is literally, I mean, this is crazy how, you know, big K1 is, you know, and fighters, I mean, Nessa Hoos, Peter Erz, Romulo Banner, Andy Hoog, Francisco Filho, Mike Bernardo, you know, may they rest in peace. But these were just great times, and you never knew who was going to win the Grand Prix that year, because everybody was, there was this top eight, top 10 guys that was just on in this league fighting for that number one spot.
What do you remember about some of the fighters on the roster? Having spoken to other guys, some were more, or the stories that I hear, some of the guys were more cordial than others. Any sort of key rivalries or other sort of moments that you kind of remember from that period?
I think the only person that kind of, like for me, like I'm not a guy that, like I'm all about respect, and I'd always show my opponents respect. And it didn't matter how big you were, how tough you were, or how skillful you are, or how much of a badass you think you are, I'm always going to show you respect until you cross that line, and then you're going to see the other side of me. You know what I mean? And but the only guy that I felt like was always kind of a standoff, like he would always be standoffish, you know, like, and later on in time, I found out this is how he prepares. He wants, now I don't know if this is true or not, and Jerome can correct me or not, but some people have said that he likes to hate his opponents so that he can fight well in the ring. Once I heard that, I kind of understood that. You know, it's not my style of doing things, but I can understand it, that everybody has their own way of preparing and staying focused and whatnot. You know what I mean? And so, but all in all, I mean, like I've made some amazing friends, Sam Greco, Francisco Filho, Nessa Hoos, Peter Erz, Mike Bernardo when he was alive. Yeah, so, you know, a lot of these guys, we become really good friends. Mark Hunt, I think a lot of that.
You left out a key detail. You didn't tell us who that was.
In what?
You said the guy who has to hate you to fight you. You left out the name.
Sorry. That was Jerome LeBanner.
Oh, LeBanner. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And so, you know, he just felt like he was always on the outside. Like even like once we all, like for many years, you know, we all had paid, we all respected each other and we all considered each other friends, but friends where you weren't afraid to, you know, punch him and knock him out.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like there was that respect more than friends, if you will. And
sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and Jerome was always kind of on the outside.
Okay.
But that, and again, I had always wondered why until later on I had asked, and that's what some of the guys said. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I kind of like understood it once they said it.
I have to ask about him because when he dropped into the promotion and sort of was able to run roughshod over a few guys, what did you think about the appearance of Bob Sapp coming in, and especially those two fights with Ernesto Hoost? As I mentioned to you, we recently spoke with Peter Graham, who I trained with for about five years in Sydney, and he was so appreciative of. He said Ernesto Hoost is the greatest kickboxer ever. He said, you know, wonderful footwork, can walk in and do that, and he just said, you know, but what Bob Sapp was able to do, sort of on size alone, was it seems almost disrespectful that just some ballooned up guy can come in and kind of demonstrates that size really does matter.
Yeah. I think the biggest, you know, initials, you know, he's a, I mean, he's Mr. Perfect for a reason in terms of his style, and he's, you know, he's so methodical and so technical in what he does and what he did. But what I felt like he didn't have was that pure strength of power. Mm. And when you fight someone like Bob Sapp, who is nothing but a muscle-bound dude, like even when I fought him, he went like this. I mean, look, I cover my face, and you can throw a punch through that, right?
Can't do that with him.
I couldn't do it with him. You know, his arm was like this. I couldn't punch through. So, you're right, and that's exactly what it was. It was just pure strength that was able to outmuscle Ernesto. And I was, you know, and I was with Ernesto, I think, in 2016, 4 years ago, when we got inducted into the International Martial Arts Hall of Fame. He told me, you know, that's probably the most, I don't want to say regretful, I kind of remember the word he used, but it's one of the fights that it was such a downer in his career, because a guy who's just a muscle bound was able to beat him. You know what I mean?
Mm, I know what you
not
mean.
Not just beat him, you know, not just beat him, but stop him twice.
Mm. It kind of harkens back to that sort of idea of like the bodybuilder versus martial artist, and it's hard on the ego.
Right, exactly. And and with me, on the other hand, I mean, I would stand and bang with, you know, the best of them. Win or lose, I'll be right there and you know, make sure that I get some of mine in if I lose, you know what I mean?
Mm.
And so when I fought Bob, he was trying to do the same thing. I mean, I guess that's what he does with everybody. He's trying to out-muscle everybody.
I remember his fights. He'd just walk up, just kind of shove you into the corner, and just off we go.
Right. And when, you know, once he realized he wasn't going to just out-muscle me, and that when punches, when I started landing stuff, he was hurting. And so it was just tough to see when he actually beat Ernesto. And like I said, beat him twice like that. But it's also understandable because he's such a freaking big guy. I mean, he's 6 foot 6, 6 foot 7, 370 pounds. Yeah. You know,
what did you think of? You know, K1 was already readily established, and then Pride kind of entered into the fold at around 2000, and you still would have been around there. What did you sort of think about the onset of MMA and its gradual growth to begin to compete with K1 in that market?
I mean, Pride was great too. But K1, I mean, I don't know if you know, but a lot of people don't know that back then K1 actually owned 20% of Pride.
Was this when it was still, because Pride went through two stages. It was KRS owned, I think, at the beginning, and then it was Dream Stage later. So was K1 invested in one of those vehicles?
I think they were still, I don't know to when that changed, if that was still part, if they were still part in, you know, in that until the UFC bought it. But I mean, that's how the K1 Dynamite was born, was because of that. You know what I mean? And then, but yeah, I mean, the shows would go hand in hand, and they were just incredible. Everybody that was into MMA at the time, even when I was traveling throughout Europe and whatnot, everybody knew what Pride was, and everybody, you know, would rave about K1 and Pride. And they were amazing shows. I mean, look at where MMA is today.
We hear about the stories in Pride about athletes getting paid in cash backstage and the involvement of the Yakuza. Was there the same sort of hands in K1? It seemed like, at least initially, it was a much more cleaner and legitimate organization.
Yeah, it was. My first 2 years, I was paid in cash.
Yeah, right. Okay.
you walk down, you know, you walk down, you sign me, they hand you $40,000. I'm like, huh? You know? So the first 2 years for me, that's how we were paid. And then, or was it three? And then after that, it changed where now they were, you know, wiring your pay and whatnot.
And do you remember much of what happened with the demise of the organization? Because I think you were one of the athletes that were left quite a bit out of pocket towards the end.
I was so I had a massive contract that was old, and I know that Ernesto, Peter, and a few others were owed millions and millions of dollars. But you know, a lot of that, I think, you know, as smart as it was for Mr. Ishii to create it and put it all together, I thought it was also dumb that he allowed his personal situations to drag. That also, see, the thing is, Mr. Ishii became this massive face in Japan as well. You know, and when he was trying to fight it for a few years, he's on TV the whole time. And eventually, you know, K1 lost sponsors and network deals and all that kind of stuff. So I thought it was as smart as he was to create it and started it all. It was also his own doing that actually ended up in the demise of K1.
Okay. Stylistically, I want to ask you more broadly about the way that people fight. There's because I don't think people think about it too much in terms of, you know, boxing has a lot more footwork, I think, which, you know, why they start calling it the sweet science. Traditional kickboxing has sort of sitting on that rear leg. Dutch kickboxing seems to be sort of, you know, the 1-2 with a really low leg kick. Do you have any sort of comments stylistically on the differences in these martial arts and I guess their benefits and hindrances?
Boxing, if you look at the the sweet science of obviously of hands, if you will. Boxing has the best hands in any combat sports. Muay Thai and, you know, karate probably has the best kicks, and, you know, and then see, when they talk about Dutch kickboxing, I didn't see much difference between Dutch kickboxing and the actual Muay Thai style of coaching.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. Maybe they differ a little bit here and there.
So what do you think it is then? Because they see, especially, you know, with Glory as an organization, they really seem to bandy on about the term Dutch kickboxing. Is it just the nationality then, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah. If you look at Francisco Filho and Glover Feitosa, when they do this X kick, question mark kick, right? Yeah. They call it the Brazilian kick,
yeah.
Right? And now it's known as a Brazilian. I mean, everybody kind of like around the world kind of knows that it's a Brazilian kick, but it didn't start off as a Brazilian kick.
That was a karate, you know, thing, I mean? When I was a kid.
Right. That's what I mean. So I think that when they reference Dutch kickboxing, because, you know, and again, like, I've seen the evolution of how some coaches in Holland teach, where, you know, they really teach you how to box and combine your boxing with kicking and that, you know. Henry Hoof, who's who lives in Florida, who's a great coach, he's coached many world champions. If you watch him coach, I pay more attention to his coaching now. He's putting, like, real good boxing combinations together with kicks, you know. So, again, it's I think more is because and also because if you look at K1, so many Dutch fighters became champions and also reached the highest level of the game, that I think when they say Dutch kickboxing, it's more referencing
almost like Mexican boxing or something like that.
Right. Because, you know, and again, that's my take on it. I'm not sure. I mean, other people may have a different take on it. You know what I mean? But that's what I saw when I was over there. And I've seen some coaches, like, even in, you know, corners and whatnot. I think just like anything or any martial artist, you continue to grow and you continue to learn from other coaches and other gyms and whatnot, and teams.
It's a good segue, because now I want to get into grappling and what you're doing with Randy and his team there. There's so few kickboxers who seem willing to make the transition into MMA. I know the very different sports, and I think probably right. Grappling yourself these days, you know, that it just goes very, very deep. There's a lot of transitional work. Do you think there's a hesitancy from kickboxers to, I guess, to require themselves to put in the effort to make that transition? Because it seems like MMA is where it's going to be these days. And the good strikers who have transitioned are winning titles these days.
Right. I think it comes down to their own personal, to the individual. Because if they're not willing to learn something different, something new, something that can help your game, especially if you want to get into MMA, then it's the fault is on you. You know what I mean? But it's a must do if you're a kickboxer wanting to transition into MMA, which takes me back to when I first joined Randy's gym team 13 years ago when it first started. And I think I joined the team maybe 3-4 months after it opened. And so Jay Haran, who's a good friend of mine, who is now, you know, an actor, stuntman, and doing amazing things there. But Jay, when he was still competing, anyway, I went with Jay, and Jay fights at 170. And we're going ding-ding-ding, and, you know, I was able to just pick my own shots. And then Jay shot in, I think it was a double leg, and took me down. And I was like, I think I was like 240 at the time.
Yeah.
245. And I couldn't get him off me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how is this guy being, how is he so heavy? You know what I mean? Because, I mean, I was a little, I mean, I was a fish out of water. You know what I mean?
And Jay Heron's noticeably smaller than you, because I think I remember him fighting middleweight welterweight GSP when he was in the UFC before he went. I think spent most of his career in the IFL, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. Well, he fought in the IFL, and then I started coaching him when he fought for Affliction, and then he got signed to the UFC again.
That's where I said I bumped into you guys, because I went to, what was it, UFC Fight Night in Sydney, and you would have been cornering Martin Campman, and I went to the hotel or something afterwards, and all three of you guys were hanging out in the lobby together. That was 2011 or sometime around then, long time ago.
We actually met there?
Yeah, I got a photo, because I was surprised to see all three of you guys all hanging out, because I think he had just fought Thiago Alves, I think, was the fight that he was headlining back then. Yeah, and all three of you guys were hanging out in the lobby together, and I was like, look at that.
Why didn't you just tell me that in the beginning?
Well, I couldn't. I think I asked you because you said I was living in Vegas, and I said, when did you move out there? Because I had no idea that you would move. You said, I've been living out here for years already. I was like, oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've been in the States for 25 years now, I think.
How did Randy Couture, my all-time favorite MMA fighter of all time, bar none, he starts Extreme Couture, but going back a few more years, there was Team Quest that he was doing with like Dan Henderson and Matt Lindland, these guys. Do you know anything about why that ended up dissolving and I guess how Extreme Couture came out of that?
I don't know exactly how that went about, but I know that Randy wanted to open his own thing, especially here in Vegas, because the Team Quest was in the state, was in, they had one in, I think it was in California, in LA, I think. But then wasn't there a Team Quest somewhere else as well?
I don't know, because I don't really know how it ended up dissolving, but as soon as Extreme Couture started up, I think Forrest Griffin ended up over there, and it instantaneously from its inception, I think it became sort of a real key fight camp.
Yeah, no, I don't know exactly if there was something that went on, but I know that, you know, Randy also wanted to open his own thing, you know, start his own thing. So, coming back to Jay. So what I did is, you know, and to the question about kickboxers wanted to transition to MMA, what I did from that, what I learned from that is that I knew nothing about the ground, which I didn't, you know? And in my own mind, I thought, okay, you know, if I stick and move, he's not going to be able to get to me. Well, when you got a pretty good wrestler like Jay, that's eventually going to happen, and you're eventually going to end up on your back.
Yes.
So what I did is I ended up signing up with Brian Kick's class at Extreme, and I wrestled for a year, 3 days a week for a whole straight year, to just so that I could, defend a takedown, and also, you know, I would get my own takedowns here and there, but mainly it was more defensive wrestling and scrambling and getting back up to my feet and using what, you know, I'm good at, and that's striking.
Brawl and brawl, right?
Exactly. And so if any kickboxer, stand-up fighter, boxer that wants to go to MMA, you got to wrestle. Jiu-jitsu is something that can come a little bit later, but you have to wrestle, because one way or the other, if you don't, you're going to end up in your back, and then they're going to feel heavy, and then elbows and punches are going to become heavier. And
and you were saying as well, you even train in the gi these days, do you?
Right. I've been training gi with Ronnie now for since the beginning of this year, I think, or late last year. Yeah, no, late last year. Mm. So Yeah, I just wanted to experience it, and now I really want to, you know, it's almost another. I love learning, and especially when it's to do with martial arts. And so, when I think I know something, there's something else. Like, it's just, and what I'm realizing with gi jiu-jitsu, obviously, no gi is, you know, obviously a lot different.
Yes.
And you can, you know,
it's all just leg locks these days. It's sit on your bum and attack legs and heels. It's a very different game.
Right. But with gi, there's so much more variables and techniques to, you know, to everything. Like, when you got something down, something else, this, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to do this, you got to do that. But the cool thing about it, and what's making me so loving it so much, is it reminds me of striking. Because striking, yeah.
Right, okay.
It's, when you break striking down to per half an inch here, half an inch there, can change, you know, a certain shot, and you know, the footwork, how to kick, how to set it up, how to draw somebody in, how do you draw somebody out, how do you make somebody move the way you want him to move. You know, there's so many variables in striking. Excuse me. And I'm finding that with gi jiu-jitsu. There's so many things to learn, which is truly amazing, and I'm loving it, because when I doing kickboxing for so many years, you go, okay, you know, after a while it gets kind of stalemate, you know.
I know what you mean. Well, BJJ, the depth of it doesn't change either, because it, as you said, you can wrestle, you can play on the top, you can play on the bottom. I mean, I think we're both getting older, so this sort of inverted guard stuff probably isn't for us. Yep. But there's a whole bunch of things that you can do, and I find it unique because the game is still evolving. It seems like it is still the only martial art where, like, next year someone's going to pull something out of the worlds, and now you're going to have to learn to deal with that.
Right. No, exactly. And that's the great thing about MMA, is that you're constantly learning. And because it's still a very young sport, that there's so many things that's to come, you know? So many things, that, and so much more to learn.
Schiavello also wanted me to ask about this, and this is going to be really interesting to a lot of people down here in these countries. He said that you were very, very good friends with All Blacks representative, one of the greatest union players of all time, in Jonah Lomu. How did that come about?
I had met Jonah on various occasions, to, you know, where there was some sort of function or whatever. But I got to know Jonah more when he started getting involved. I started to become really good friends with Jason Ramore, who was also one of my teammates. And super nice guy, like, great guy. But what an athlete he was, you know. May he rest in peace. But he was just an amazing human being. And the person that I knew, he was very humble, down to earth. You know, again, Jason Ramore knew him better than I did, you know what I mean? But the person that I knew was just a kind-hearted guy, and also just a very humble human being.
What is it about, why is rugby union so entrenched in New Zealand? I mean, it's probably even more so the way that Canadians view hockey. It is really the game down there.
Because when you're 5 years old, you're playing rugby. You know what I mean? It's the national sport. You know, growing up, that's all we knew how to play was rugby. Like, soccer wasn't even heard of, if you will. And as a young kid, rugby was the game. A little later, rugby league became a massive thing there too. And but rugby union, I don't know, to, you know, I haven't seen a rugby league game in years. But every now and then I see, you know, the All Blacks playing on ESPN.
Yeah.
And so it's, but yeah, I mean, that's, you know, New Zealand's national sport.
We're in the finals of leagues, so there's a lot of it going on. And as you might have known, all these, what, going back 10 to 15 years ago, all the league teams down here started bringing on wrestling coaches, which is a really big, fascinating change. And most of the guys who have been involved in MMA to some degree are now involved with a league club to some degree these days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And wrestling because of what? For tackling?
So effectively, for people listening, you know, league and union are different. So in league, you've still got stand-up tackles. You've got committing 2 to 3 guys to it, you know, being able to fold and take out the legs. The grapple tackle is really big news here, which is sort of 2-on-1. So one guy grabs the upper body, one guy dips and grabs the legs, so dropping 2-on-1. And that's also created an offshoot now where there's a lot more they've tried to get it out of the game, but we're seeing pretty dangerous spear tackles because people are effectively picking them up for double legs and almost dropping them on their head, which, as you know, is pretty dangerous when you've got guys your size on the field doing that to each other.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, you've been so far removed from it, but yeah, for about the last 15 years, Larry Papadopoulos, who I trained at Boxing Works Sydney with Peter Graham, he trains the Roosters. My instructor, who I got my black belt from, Anthony Parrish, is involved with West Tigers out here. And that's been going on for a long time now, of just being able to, as you know, just in wrestling, probably a lot of stuff of just getting the underhooks, getting 2-on-1 on the arm, being able to turn them over to grab singles, and all these variations of teaching them new variations on the old hit up, I suppose.
Right. Oh, wow. Allowing the game to be to grow and also be safe, I guess it's good, right?
Well, the biggest thing that they did recently is this year they introduced 6 again. So instead of getting to the tackle and putting 1 or 2 guys on top of them to delay the play for 3 to 5 seconds so that everyone can line up 10 meters, you have to get off immediately or they'll give you 6 again. So they're now talking about what this means to the game, because you're going to have lankier, faster guys these days, because you can't stall the game by just trying to slow it down to get everyone to line up. So every game that you watch, they'll be on top of some guy and it's like 1, 2, or there's 6 again, and they just, you know, move their way down the field. Very interesting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Does that make the game faster?
I think so.
Yeah.
Some teams are having problems
with
adapting to it, because their whole game is based on that sort of stall, you know, big hit, stall, line up and wait again. So it's changing,
right.
But we're at preliminary finals now. So we're down to the last 4 teams in the league season here this year. So, yeah.
Nice.
Cool. A bit of an offshoot or getting off topic. If anyone's listened to this, they're probably not going to know where the hell we've gone with this conversation for those who know rugby league or anything.
Well, yeah, we're talking about flying and...
Yeah. So what's really interesting about this, post-career, you've now moved into doing something entirely separate, which is sitting in the executive's office. So you're now a CEO for what used to be the World Series of Fighting. And is now the Professional Fighters League. You know, we don't get a lot of that content down here, but I'm able to see some of it online. And I know, you know, guys who made their name in the UFC, like Justin Gaethje, have come through that organization. So how did you get involved with this and what are you doing with them now?
So I founded WSOF back in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And that really stemmed from a conversation, matter of fact, doing an interview. I had been, you know, I had been thinking about it, but I hadn't really, you know, how sometimes your mind goes through things and you go, okay, yep. But it didn't really stick until this interview with Tap Out Radio. And of course, I think a week prior to that, or 2 weeks prior to that, K1 filed bankruptcy and whatnot, and owing, you know, many fighters millions of dollars and whatnot. And so I was on the radio talking about that and what my next move was and so on. and a few other things. And one of them mentioned something about, you know, what I thought about somebody taking it over, K1, that is.
Yep.
I think it was UFC, I think it was, that they mentioned. I was like, yeah, man, that would be so awesome. You know what I mean? But it was also in that interview that something clicked in that interview, and I was like, okay. When I got off the phone with that interview, I really was like, okay, this, I've been thinking about it for a while, starting my own league, fight league. But I think it's time. So I called up one of my friends, and he didn't answer. Then I was told that he was away somewhere. And then this was a Friday night, and then Saturday morning I called him again, or he called me, one or the other. And, we had a conversation, and he's like, I'm like, hey, listen, I've been meaning to talk to you, but let's catch up for breakfast. And he's like, yeah, what are you doing? I'm off to strength and conditioning. So let me, you know, let's do that. And I'll do that. And then we'll catch up. And that was, you know, we sat down, we talked about how I wanted to start a fight league that using the K1 from my own experiences, I wanted to do, you know, that K1 format kind of where,
tournament.
Where you fought, right, where you fought throughout the year. I mean, we can't, but I wanted it to be something different because K1, you fought throughout the year, and then October, I think September, October, you fought in the top 16, and then the winning eight became the Grand Prix where you fought three times in one night.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do something similar to that, but also – but then also put it in the American way of sports, where there was, you know, there's a regular season, playoffs, and then championships.
Yep.
So things didn't turn out exactly the way they were planned. So WSOF ended up for the first, I want to say first 4 to 5 years, we did, you know, the normal format where, you know, it was a promotion. We did shows and, you know, and then when the group that we have now for PFL, when they came on board, they loved that idea of putting it into, and of course, Carlos Silva also helped with that as well. Who at the time was our CEO, and a good friend. And, so, you know, we were able to put that together and we also changed the name from WSOF, which is a Fighting to Professional Fighters League. And the format itself was born, in terms of doing, MMA for the first time in a league format where, you win, you move on. You lose, you go home. You know what I mean? And the way, you know, obviously, the way it works is within the playoffs, you earn points to qualify for the playoffs. In the regular season, you earn points to qualify for the playoffs. And you fight twice in one night. And if you win the semifinals, so you fight a quarterfinal and a semifinals in the playoffs. And if you win the semifinals, then you're in the championship at the end of the year. Our first year was with NBC, and then our second year was we signed a deal with ESPN, which we're very blessed and thankful for. Of course, this year, what happened with the pandemic with COVID-19. We entered early on. We decided to postpone the season for the safety of our fighters and, of course, our staff members and everybody involved. And also, by the time I think by August, when things were starting to certain sports were starting to come back. It was already too late for us to start a season because it takes 8 months for the season to be completed. And so, yeah, so the season for PFL this year has been postponed, and we're looking at a few options to maybe do one or two shows towards the end of the year, but those are still in the works, and we'll see what happens.
Awesome. Well, look, Ray, I think we've had you on for about 90 minutes, for about an hour and a half. So, look, I appreciate your time today, and it was a really good chat. And who knows, maybe we can do it again at some time down the track.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Jess.
Of course, no worries. Cheers.
Take care. Bye bye. Awesome.
This episode is brought to you by Romulus IT, offering fast, affordable remote support for common computer problems, including troubleshooting, health checks, virus removal, and software support. Visit RomulusIT.com to get your computer back on track.